Well, I want to start tonight by asking a couple questions. First question is, what does it mean? What do you mean when you say you know someone? If I ask you, do you know Joe? You say, oh yeah, I know Joe. What do you mean by that?
Heard of him.
Say what?
Heard of him.
You've heard of him, okay. What else?
Know their tendencies.
You know their tendencies, okay.
You've had a meaningful interaction with them.
You've had a meaningful interaction, okay. Jeremy, you've seen Joe's Facebook page. Good, okay.
I can connect their name to their face.
Ah, you can connect their name to their face. Okay, good. It's a good plug for name tags, by the way. Best community tool, right? You can remember people's names right away. What else? I don't know him.
Right. But if you're like, oh, hey, you know, there is some, I have this friend, and, oh, yeah, I know him. I think it depends on the conversation.
Yeah, good. So there's levels, right? Mm-hmm. There's, like, different ways of meaning that. Okay. What else?
You know what they value.
You know what they value. Okay. You have a relationship with them. Okay, good. All right, so let's say that there is somebody you don't know, or rather that doesn't know you, all right, and you want them to know you. What might you do? What actions might you take so that this person knows you? What's that?
Introduce yourself,
okay?
Friend request
on Facebook, all right. Poke them. Reasons not to know Jeremy.
Invite them to an activity,
okay?
Mutual friend.
What do you mean?
Get a mutual friend to introduce
you. Okay, get a mutual friend to introduce you. Okay, good. Yeah.
Send them an email,
okay?
Ask them out for a date.
Ask them out for a date, okay? Ezra wants to know this person. Good. What else?
Mimic them.
What?
Mimic them.
Interesting, okay. Yeah.
Carpool on a retreat,
good, okay.
That's true, that's very true.
Very specific way of spending time with them, right?
Worked out for you,
there you go. Okay, good. Good, well, we're in the middle of this series for the summer that we're calling Why, and it's trying to address the hard questions of faith, the difficult questions, the questions that sometimes prevent people from coming to faith, questions that even if you've grown up in the church, you might still have, the things that sometimes are hard even to ask, because you go to church, you go to some Christian type event, and there's can almost be an implicit assumption that everybody believes these seven things, and so it feels awkward to say, well, I'm not sure about this one, how does it work? And so we want to be asking those this summer. We want to foster an environment where it's safe to ask those, and it's okay, and you can ask kind of whatever you want. I was actually just having a conversation with somebody earlier this week, and this person was asking some hard questions, and they were saying, these are the questions you can't ask in church. And I thought, oh, that's too bad. Like, you should be able to ask any question in church. This should not be a place where you are assumed to believe something, or you are looked down upon for having questions. This should be a place where we're exploring, and we're discovering, and we're journeying together. So a little part of me died when the person said that, like, oh, I can't ask that question. Yes, you can. You can ask any question you want. So that's what we're doing this summer, trying to face those questions. And tonight, we're looking at the question of the Bible. And so if we're going to be talking about Christianity, about why, about the questions, why Christianity might be true, any discussion like that has to talk about the Bible at some point. Christianity claims something remarkable about this book. And it claims that this text is some kind of an authority for a whole lot of things. And of course, different traditions will have different ways of understanding what that authority means. But at any rate, this book is central to what Christianity has been for 2,000 years. And so, if you're going to doubt Christianity, you could start by doubting the Bible. And if you're going to have faith, it's got to have something to do with the Bible. And I think that in our culture, probably the Bible, you know, if the Bible had like hired a PR firm or something, it probably would be like, man, you got to work on your image, you got to work on your branding, your Facebook page stinks. Like, I think the Bible in our culture probably doesn't have a really good reputation. I think people see it as outdated or irrelevant, confusing, all sorts of things. And so I want to think tonight about why might we have faith in the Bible? And also think a little bit, I have a little hope that we might kind of renovate the image of the Bible a little bit. I think perhaps the Bible doesn't get as much credit as it could. And so we want to think a little bit about what a remarkable book this is. And it's really, I believe these things, but the things that we or that Christians claim to believe about this book are really crazy things to believe, right? I mean, Christians believe that the God of the universe, who created everything, and who is bigger than all of us, and who is infinite and eternal, like, spoke these words over the course of maybe, depending on your dating, 1,500, 2,000 years, through many different authors, that people collected them, and that something about these words that are just words on a page, it's just ink on a page, something about this actually reveals God himself. And that's like, I mean, I understand why people are like, that doesn't make sense, because that's crazy. That's really an audacious claim to make of a book. And yet, that's the claim that I would make and that the church has made for a long time. And so that's the claim we want to be thinking about tonight. So we're going to talk about three different ideas, three different ways to understand why the Bible might be significant. And just to kind of prepare you, we've been breaking up after our talks and going into small groups. And one of the questions this evening will be, of these three things, which one of them kind of resonates with you the most? So be listening and kind of thinking, well, that part makes sense, that part doesn't make sense, stuff like that. I want to talk about the Bible kind of philosophically. Like, does it make sense? Is it reasonable that if there is a God, and if there is a God like the Christian God, that he might reveal himself in this way? Is that a reasonable idea, kind of on a philosophical basis? That's the first idea we want to explore. And then we want to look at the evidence, like, what's the physical evidence about this book? Who wrote it? How many copies are there of it? How did they write it? How do I have this book with artificial or maybe real leather that now, when it was like written thousands of years ago, what happened? Like, what's the evidence behind this book being something unique? It's the second idea we want to consider. And then third, we want to think about, what has this book done throughout history in people's experience, in our own experience, and what does that say about what this book might be or not be? All right, ready? All right, here we go. So, first of all, we want to think about, is it kind of philosophically reasonable that God might reveal himself through this book? And I want you to think back to the things that we said, that you guys said about, if you want somebody to know you, what steps might you take so that they could know you? So there were things like invitations, there were things like Facebook invites, there were things like spending time with them, talking to them. And what we want to start by thinking about with the Bible is, if there is a God, and if this God created us, and if this God wants us to know him, what options are available to him to make that happen? What could God have done so that we could know him? And does it make sense? Is it reasonable to think that what he did do is this Bible? And that's how he chose to make himself known. So, another kind of little plug, but also relevant. I'm going to look at the first chapter of John. Because in John's Gospel, he talks about Jesus. He introduces this guy, Jesus. And the way he does it, he draws all these comparisons between Jesus and what John calls the Word, or in Greek, Logos. And so there's this really interesting comparison between Jesus as a person and what Jesus does as an individual and what the Word of God as the Bible does in the world. And so this is written about Jesus the person, but there's this strong parallel between what role the Bible plays in the world. So John says this, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning." And then he says this, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." So there's this idea then that in the beginning, the Word existed. That is Jesus. And there's this sense of like otherness, like the Word was out there and the Word was with God. And so that's like apart from us. And then there's this powerful idea that somehow the Word took on flesh. The Word who was other, who was divine, became something that made sense in this world. And the theological term for that is incarnation. So that God became something that could be understood by his creation. And that's a remarkable idea in and of itself. It says the Word made his dwelling among us. And the purpose for that then is a little bit later in verse 18. "No one has ever seen God, but God the one and only who is at the Father's side and implicitly is the one who came down, who was made flesh. God, the one and only who is at the Father's side, has made him known." And so the idea that John is getting at is that God sent Jesus partly so that he himself, God, might be known. And the way that he did that, the way he chose to do that, was to become flesh himself. So something that is other became like his creation, so that his creation might know him. How many of you guys work with kids or have worked with kids? So let's say like there's a small person, right? And like I walk up and I want to talk to said small person, right? What's the first thing I do? What? Get on their level, right? I do this, right? I get down to talk to them face to face. Because if I'm like this, "Hello, small person. What do you want to play?" Right? Like, that doesn't work. But if I get down, right, immediately, like now I can talk to them. I can interact with them. That's like working with children 101, right? You get down on their level. So it's the same thing. That's what God does. He says, this creation of mine, these people I made, they can't understand me if I'm up here talking to them. I have to get down on their level. So that's what God did by sending Jesus. But the same can be understood about this book. And it's almost, in fact, some religions would say that's blasphemy. Like, how could God, the creator of things, become something as mundane, as earthy, as simple and plain as a man? Or how could God reveal himself through words on a page? That doesn't make sense. There's an almost tension there. And yet, that's part of the beauty of the Christian God, that the Christian God would say, I got to get down on their level. They're not going to know me unless I talk to them in their language. And so the Bible then becomes this method of God, who is bigger, revealing himself to his people. And as I think about it, it's kind of like, well, yeah, of course. Like, how else would he? How else would God make himself known? How else would he reveal himself, if he exists, except through words to people? And the particular manner in which he did this, through many people across time, in different cultures, men and women, different personalities, and yet somehow it's all the same. Like, there's this commonality in this book, this universalness of agreement that speaks to the idea that it is inspired by something common. So the story the Bible tells then about how God chose to reveal himself is that in early times, it seems as if shortly after creation and in the pages of Genesis, it seems as if people had some innate knowledge of God, or there was some way that they related to him. Adam and Eve walked with him. It seems to be some of the early people that were there before the Bible that there was some way that God made himself known. But pretty soon, God said, I'm going to choose somebody to write down stuff about me. I'm going to speak through someone. And God chose Moses to speak through. And God chose these spokespeople to speak through. Moses, Abraham, the prophets, the psalmists, the judges. And so these became people that would then mediate God's person to someone else. This is the mutual friend, right? God said, okay, well, you'll get to know me because we both know Moses. And you can read Moses, and we'll know each other. And so then there's this kind of gradual, as history went on, this gradual collection of those writings and that stuff that was at the beginning organic and kind of very natural and repeated orally across traditions became formalized, became codified, became written down, became regarded as something different than something somebody else would write. And so there's this recognition of a category of stuff called scripture. There's something special about it. And then Jesus came, and pretty quickly the stuff that was written about Jesus, the stuff that Jesus said, became regarded as, hey, this is as important as that stuff. And so Jesus' words pretty quickly became regarded as scripture, and they were written down and collected by others, and certain people wrote about him, and there's this kind of collection of stuff that then became set to say, this is the stuff that really something deeper than that's on the surface is going on with this writing, which is different from the stuff that Paul Taylor is going to blog about 2,000 years later, right? Like, this is something unique, right? And that's this process. And I think if you just kind of consider, like, does it make sense that God might do that? Now, that doesn't answer the question, did God do that? But if he did it, it's reasonable to expect it to be kind of philosophically reasonable. So is it reasonable that God would choose this method to reveal himself? And I would argue that it is. But this is a remarkable way of revealing himself. It says a lot about his own values, about valuing people, about valuing different people, about drawing people together, about being accurate in the way he represents himself, and yet being poetic at the same time. Just that manner of self-revelation says a lot. So in the same way that if you wanted somebody to know you and you Facebook poked them, that would say a lot about you. And they would know immediately, oh, this is this kind of person. Versus if you invited them over for a candlelit dinner, that would say something else about you, right? So the way that God has chosen to make himself known to us says something about who he is, if this is indeed true. So that's kind of the first idea, like this philosophically reasonable, is that it doesn't make sense that God would do this. And I would say yes. The second idea I want to talk about is it objectively authoritative? Like, if we look at just the data, the physical evidence, what do we make of that? And so to do this, we want to think a little bit about documents that we have. So if you went to school and you learned about things that happened before you or your teachers existed, You learned about those things. Somebody learned about those things from some authority, right? So we read people like Plato and Aristotle and historians, and we know about Caesar, and we know about Egyptian kings, and we know about Asian empires, and we know about this stuff. But how do we know about it? We know about it from the documents that were written about it. So it's interesting then to compare different documents. So here's an example. Plato, you learn about Plato, and when you go to school, somebody gives you a book and says, Plato wrote this, right? And you read it, and they say, this is Plato. Well, Plato is assumed to have written around 400 BC, so that'd be about 2,400 years ago. The earliest copy that we have of Plato's works is written around 900 AD. So that means that there is about 1,300 years between when Plato wrote something down and the actual copy that we have in our possession of what Plato is said to be written. Does that make sense? So then we don't really know what happened in those 1,300 years, right? Like maybe the guy 100 years earlier said, I'm going to write this and sign Plato. And that's what we have. So we don't know. So when you're looking at ancient documents, the time span between when it was written and the date of the earliest, what they call manuscript we have, kind of is one indication of how reliable that is. In addition, we have around seven ancient copies of Plato's works, okay? And so when you have different copies, the more copies you have, the more reliable you think it might be. So that's Plato. Aristotle wrote around the same time. For Aristotle, it's better. He wrote around 400 BC. We actually have a copy of his works from 100 AD. So that's only about 500 years, right? That's pretty good. But like 500 years, that's like a long time ago, right? I mean, like, that was like Martin Luther 500 years ago. A lot has happened in 500 years. So, but that's pretty good for Aristotle. We have 49 copies of what he wrote. So that's pretty good too. We have more than seven. Have any of you heard of Pliny? Yeah. What do you know about Pliny?
The older or the younger?
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I think the younger. What's that?
The historian.
Yeah, historian. Roman historian. Good. So from Pliny, we know about people like Caesar. We know a bunch of stuff about Roman life. We know all this history. And we just learn it because we have Pliny to tell us about it, right? This is a good little tidbit you can use with your friends, you know. Bring up Pliny in conversation. It's always a winner at parties. So Pliny wrote around 80 AD, right? The earliest copy we have of Pliny, I just love saying that name. The earliest copy we have of Pliny's works are from 850 AD. All right, so that's maybe 800 years, so that's kind of in between. We have about seven copies of his, but Pliny is one of the primary sources for the information we have about Roman life, Caesar, and how the Caesar system worked and how Roman government worked. So it's interesting. Like, we base a lot of our supposed knowledge on this work that has an 800-year gap between when it was written and when we have it. Okay? How many of you read the Iliad? Right? Homer's the Iliad. Good stuff, right? Okay, so this is an interesting one. Homer wrote the Iliad around 900 BC, so really, really early. The earliest copy we have of his work is actually really old. We have a copy from 400 BC. So that's like a long, long time ago, right? And again, about 500 years in between when it was written and the copy we have. And we have a lot of copies of the Iliad because somebody thinks it's a really good book. So we have 643 ancient manuscripts of the Iliad. So I think that's why they have us read it, because they're like, all right, somebody long ago thought this was good. We should think it's good too, right? So that's like the most by orders of magnitude, 643. We have nothing comes close to that in terms of other ancient documents. Everything else is in like the 7 to 50 range of the other ones we talked about. This is just a sampling of things. All right, so what about the Bible? What about the New Testament? If we have these standards for are ancient texts reliable, what about the Bible? Well, the New Testament was written in about a 50-year span, between around 50 AD and 100 AD, give or take, 30 to 50 years, in that period, okay? That's when all of these books were written. Who knows when the earliest copy of the New Testament we have is from? Anybody?
It's another little party tidbit.
What's that? Fragment. The earliest fragment, not the earliest entire copy.
Like around 100?
150, somewhere in the middle, around 130 AD. It's a fragment of the Gospel of John, actually. And then kind of as you get later, we have more and more fragments, and the earliest complete manuscript is later. But the earliest reference, the earliest tidbit of manuscript we have is from about 130. So that's maybe like 40, 50 years after it's written. And we have complete manuscripts from, I'm forgetting the date actually. 250, 300. So only maybe 200 years after the New Testament was written. Does anybody know how many copies, ancient manuscript, original language copies of the New Testament we have? More than 7. Anybody? 12. More than 12.
1,400.
More than 1,400. Not quite 14,000. 5,600. Okay? This is 5,600 partial or full manuscripts of the Greek New Testament. Ancient, written on like cool papyri and like sheepskin and cool stuff like that, right? So if you're just going on like, now this doesn't mean it's true, right? It just means that what we have is very close to what was written. Does that make sense? So this document is very accurate, an accurate representation of what was originally written. And accurate on a scale, an order of magnitude, unlike any other document we have in our possession as a culture, right? So that's remarkable. And it implies, I mean, the Iliad's a good book, right? 643 copies. But it implies that people thought something really remarkable about this book. There's great care taken to produce massive quantities, to disseminate it all over. Cool stuff. Okay. So that's some objective data. There's a few other things. At several points in history, people have said, well, the Bible talks about this, and it must not really exist, because I don't read about it anywhere else. So one example is like the Canaanites. For a long time, people thought there were no Canaanites, because we've never heard of them. Only the Bible talks about them. And then in the 1970s, people discovered something called the Ebla tablets. And these are these tablets written in Syrian cuneiform, right? And they mention the Canaanites. And people are like, oh, well, okay, maybe the Canaanites do exist. It's like, okay, fine, right? But this other group, the Hittites, well, we've never heard of them. So occasionally these things happen, where like people just believe that this doesn't exist, and then archaeological evidence will come out that demonstrates the proof of this. So again, in pieces, none of this is like, oh my gosh, you're right, I should be a Christian. The Ebla tablets mention the Canaanites, right? like, it's all pieces of data, right? But you kind of add it all together. It's part of the puzzle. Then there's arguments from like the prophetic authority. And this is interesting because there's all these prophecies in the Old Testament that then came true in later times. Things about like the destruction of the temple. Things about certain world powers that would rise to prominence and fall. And in particular, there's a bunch of prophecies around the circumstances of the Messiah, who Jesus would be, where he would come from, the fact that there would be a messenger that preceded him, the fact that he would come from Bethlehem, the fact that he would suffer, the fact that at his death people would cast lots to take his garments, the fact that he would be rejected, the fact that he would later be glorified. So there's all these things that then came true in the person of Jesus. And you got to say, well, at the very least, something's going on. Like, these writings were from a long time ago, a long time before Jesus. There's no denying that they were older than Jesus. And Jesus' life fits the pattern of these writings in remarkable ways. A little too remarkable to be like, you know, the $10 psychic that's like, you have a conflict in your life. I can sense it. Right? Like, this is more specific than you might otherwise assume, right? So there's prophetic stuff that is data to say, well, maybe this book is something remarkable. Then, and this is the thing that's really, I think, personally powerful to me. There's this internal consistency within the Bible. And I would say more than consistency, there's this internal beauty. There's this narrative that if you were at PBC for the last year, we tried to expound, right? That begins in Genesis, ends in Revelation, books that are written at the least a millennia apart, right? And yet the story is like connected. And if you read Genesis 1 and 2 and Revelation 20 and 21, it's the beginning and the end of a story. And there's these amazing parallels from authors that were completely disconnected in culture and time and language and everything. And the way that the Bible introduces a problem, develops that problem, goes through several possible solutions to the problem, each of which successively fail in more and more spectacular ways until finally a new solution arises that is what you'd expect and yet completely different than what you'd expect, that then solves the problem and then gives birth to this whole new thing. I mean, the story is amazing, and the fact that it's written over this length of time by different authors, that's one of the most compelling arguments to me personally. And then the fact that that story makes sense of our lives, I think. It makes sense of the types of questions we're asking this summer. Why do bad things happen? Why is there pain? What's going to happen? Can I have hope? The fact that this story, it's just the best story out there. I mean, it's not all the answers we want, but even that, to me, is evidence that there's legitimacy there. Because if it just, like, gave me what I wanted to hear, I'd be like, well, it can't be true, you know? If this book just tells me everything I want to hear, oh, you're good looking, and you're great, and you're smart, and you can do anything, like, if it's that type of book, I'll be like, it can't be true. But the fact that it comforts me and challenges me at the same time means something's remarkable is might be going on. So there's this kind of consistency within this book that I think is some objective data to say there's something special. So the first point is this idea that it's philosophically reasonable. Second point is that there's this objective authority that it demonstrates through data. And the third idea we want to think about is what this book has done through history and in the experience of individuals. So from the beginning, this book was regarded as something special. The events that were described in it in ancient times, in the first century, people were willing to die because they said they believed it. They said, I believe that this thing happened. Jesus Christ rose from the dead. I believe it so firmly that if you tell me, all you got to do is say it's not true. And if you don't say it, I'm going to burn you alive. I'll choose being burned alive. Now, that doesn't mean it's true, but it does mean that that person really thinks it's true, right? And the fact that there were a lot of people that really thought it was true, really close to the events that happened, and that this book then became the kind of authoritative record for those events in history. And there was all this stuff that happened in the first few centuries around figuring out what should be in this book, what this book means, who this person Jesus is, that it was the center of so much discussion and thought, and then it became the guide for this major religious effort that swept the world. And then to me, even the experience in history of the conflict that this book has caused is worth considering as something, as a data point to say, well, there's something special about this book. Like, the fact that it's caused so many problems means maybe something's going on. The fact that one story is a guy named William Tyndale. Anybody know his story? He's an English scholar, and he translated the Bible into English in the 16th century, one of the first ones to do so from the original Hebrew and Greek. He did this during a time where it was illegal to own a copy of the Bible in English. So this was pre-Reformation. This was when people, the church believed the Bible should only be in Latin, right? Pretty glad that changed. So William Tyndale, among others, thought, well, we should have it in English so we can actually, you know, read it and stuff. So he translated it, and for that, he got strangled and burned at the stake for translating the Bible into English. What's interesting is one of the reasons he got in so much trouble is that he claimed that the Bible, he was English, and he said that Henry VIII was divorcing his wife, and the Bible says that's wrong. Now, think about what that means in a monarch, in a monarchy, in the 16th century. You're a person, and you're talking to the king, and you're saying you're doing something wrong because this book says so. Like, you're taking this book and you're saying, this book exists as some higher authority by which I, even though I'm below you, have the authority to judge you. That's a really remarkable thing to say. And it basically got him killed. So, but that's what he believed about this book. And what's amazing is his dying wish is that the king would change his mind, and then 2 years later, the king's like, oh, well, that guy William was probably right. We should have an English Bible. And he commissioned an English Bible. So, kind of sucks to be 2 years early, I guess. And then, of course, Tyndale's Bible actually became the model for the King James Bible. That was the standard English Bible for centuries. So, even the fact that people would kill someone else because of this book, and that they would choose to die because of this book, that they'd be willing to die, that to me is evidence that says something, there's something about this book. There's something special. And then lastly, my personal experience with this book, and the personal experience of a lot of you that I know, and a lot of Christians around the world, that these words are different than other words. That you read them and they touch you in different ways, they speak to you, that challenge you, that comfort you. You can study them. I'm amazed at the breadth of this book, that it fascinates me on an academic level, that I can study it, its history and its background. And then at times it speaks to me on an emotional level, that I can be in tears and it can comfort me and I can resonate with the emotions, that it can help me practically to make decisions. I mean, the kind of ways that this book has interacted with my life is so diverse. And in each of those, it's always like over the top fascinating, over the top powerful, over the top practical. Like, it's just remarkable in all those ways. And I'm not the only one that's had that type of experience. So, this book, the Bible, the question for tonight is, why believe the Bible? And ultimately, none of these are like determinative, right? None of these are things that you're going to say, absolutely, I must believe the Bible because of these things. And yet, this is a choice. This is a choice of faith. And it's worth pointing out that everything we believe, every authority we listen to, is an authority that we have chosen to give, chosen to regard with authority. And so the question is, do you choose? And why would you choose to give this book authority? So we've talked about the fact that it's philosophically reasonable that God would choose to reveal himself in this way. That there is objective data to say that this book has some remarkable aspects to it. And that throughout history and experience of individuals, this book has proved to be a flashpoint of good and controversy and conflict and resolution and all that stuff. Just want to leave us with the idea that one of the things I love about the Bible is that it is this combination. We started off talking about the Gospel of John and how Jesus came as divine into flesh to reveal himself. And there really is a parallel between Jesus and the Bible. Jesus is fully God and he is fully man. And he is the creator of the universe and he sweats. And he cries. I mean, there's this great tension between the majestic and the mundane. And the same thing is true of the Bible. These are the words of God. They are the self-revelation of the creator of the universe. And yet, they're words with grammar and awkward grammar and hard to understand at times. And people fight over what they mean and they're confusing. And so, even that, the fact that they're so high and so low at the same time, I think is part of the beauty and mystery of the Bible.